as the fragrance of the companion, shall take a nation to the companion. Sometimes childhood memories appear before my eyes like a pale pall of imagination. Among those rippling images there sails the craft of my thought towards the shore of silence to anchor in the harbor of its own. I dwell on my existence. I want to decipher the oriental thoughts and secrets and to put an end to my bewilderment and self-alienation. I am a traveler standing on the shore of thoughts. My aim, to pinpoint my lost identity. I am a traveler, walking on the road of human thoughts. My destination is the land of belief in oneself, in a bid to revive an identity which might no longer exist. It is an identity which, like a child's toy, is played with, but in a deadly way.
Some ignorant guys sent to the slaughterhouse of death every day thousands of innocent people because they are deeply buried in the marsh of their jejune ideas. In a way, there are two types of travels, a physical one, or going from one place to another, and a spiritual one, or transforming from one mood to another. Those embarking on the first type are many in number, and those embarking on the second type are much less. My travel is a mixture of both. Within the land and the sky, a travel in time to appreciate the ideas of an Eastern philosopher, namely Allama Muhammad Iqbal, the thinker, that if his thoughts were well understood, we would not witness the ignorant behaviors by Takfiri groups that are far from Islamic injunctions and humanity these days. Allama Iqbal wrote great mysteries in his books for his son, Javed Iqbal, and all others. As an old man, Javed knows it well whom his father was addressing. Javed talks to him like this.
Right now, I am 90 years old. You don't address people of my age. You address young people. You like them to believe what I say. I personally cannot fully understand you. I follow a path not wanted by you. Talk to me, who is 90 years old. You feel the elderly usually talk in a desperate way. You advise that one should not be desperate. The right man is hidden in you. Go on with your search. He will surely appear. You are saying the same thing. You have not visited me. I did my best. I searched for 90 years, but I did not find that right man. Where is he then? Tell me if you know.
I begin my journey right from here to the city of Sialkot, the birthplace of Iqbal. Perhaps in this travel, I would be able to show some special features of that righteous man. Today, Sialkot is a city in Punjab, Pakistan. The city, when Iqbal was born, was part of India.
Oh, you who are familiar with me, come with me to the childhood alleys. Tread on memory's pathway. Come with me to my intimate's alley. In my childhood home, on roofs quite stranger to all noises, may they be merrily remembered. The period of harmony with existence and excellence. The pleasant period of being with a companion, with all its liveliness. During all the year's generous moments, those alleys full of love, the splash of pure wafers.
ये वो घर है जहाँ अल्लामा इकबाल 9 नवंबर 1877 को सुबह 5
Here is the very room wherein Iqbal was born on the 9th of November 1877 at 5:14 a.m.
इस घर की इब्तिदा की 6 फरवरी 1861
The house here was built by his grandfather Sheikh Muhammad Rafiq. He was the first to occupy the house. On the 6th of February, 1861, he bought 3 small rooms and a house near here until Iqbal was born. Later, Iqbal's elder brother came here. The house has undergone no change since then.
Iqbal's ancestors were high-ranking Brahmins of Kashmir. They converted to Islam 500 years before Iqbal was born. The family was called Siparu, meaning educated. His father was a cloth dealer. Nur Muhammad's shop was frequented by great thinkers of Islamic sects. His mother, Imam Bibi, was also a religious woman. Iqbal had one brother and 4 sisters, all of them his senior.
Rooms were built before anything else in 1861. Iqbal's family prepared the first room for the wives. There, in that room, you see a cradle and a chair.
Encouraged by his father, Muhammad Iqbal learned the Quran from his very childhood in Hissam al-Din Mosque of Kashmiris. Basic lessons were learned at home, as Iqbal says this was the best period of his lifetime, because under his father's support, his thinking foundations became established. Sialkot's graveyard tells years later, when his father died, the story of Iqbal's attachment.
So many times I've asked myself, what is existence? From where does it take root? What a secret it is that has attracted thinkers' attention. I could not find answers to those questions. Then, many years later, when my thoughts expanded, I traveled back to my childhood to find answers to my questions. There it was my father who decided on the shape a thing should take. Years later, when unknown things became clear to me, I came to understand Mir Hassan's teachings. He talked to me about the Book of Life, but he did not mention the book's title. A condition set before me by him was this: to learn new sciences, Europeans learn. It is only then that you come to know what the value of the Book of Life is. He was quite right. Years later, with all my heart, I came to fully know the Book of Life. The Book of Life, the Holy Quran, whose wisdom is eternal and solid. It is an illustration for life secrets. Its power makes the unfaithful faithful. To mankind, it is the only message. The bearer of it will enjoy the mercy of both worlds. Bandits turn into leaders just through its memorization. They become pious just with the help of this very book. He whose heart's pulsation is a result of the book's warmth, His restless way finds comfort just as does a pearl. Should you want to live a Muslim life, only through the Quran is this possible.
Sialkot, a city in northeastern Punjab province, located at the foot of the snow-clad Kashmiri Mountain. It was here, in this crowded city, where Allama Iqbal's first educational basis took root. Having received his first training by father and such a great teacher as Molina Mir Hassan, the young Muhammad entered Scotch Mission School to start his official education therein. The school's premises, against passage of centuries, keeps the same shape as it used to have.
He finished his high school here in 1891. Then in 1893, he completed his 10th grade, and it was here where he finally ended his high school education in 1895 and got his high school diploma.
Having finished his high school in Sialkot, Muhammad Iqbal found the city too small to give him an opportunity to fly higher up in the sky. Muhammad was 18 when he finished his pre-university courses with honors, receiving 2 academic gold medals. Admitted on a scholarship, he left Sialkot for Lahore as advised by his teacher Mir Hassan. Lahore was a city southwest of his birthplace, 125 kilometers away from it. Then Muhammad Iqbal went to Punjab University, one of Pakistan's oldest universities, established in 1882 by the British ruler of the Indian subcontinent in Lahore. There, the instruction language was English, though some lessons were taught in Urdu. Young Iqbal of Sialkot went there to continue his education. Very soon, he got so famous throughout the world due to his thoughts and his Persian Urdu poems. Known as Iqbal Lahori, he was destined to get his BA and MA here and composed his earliest poems.
Allama Iqbal bila shuba hamari islami duniya ka.
Undoubtedly, Iqbal is, for us in the world of Islam, a clear metaphor and a great name. Iqbal found an Islamic world a special thought. At the present time, we are living in a place so blessed as it witnessed Iqbal, the learned, for 5 years. At a time when Iqbal arrived here from Sialkot to enroll for BA, the state university here had this one dormitory only. Iqbal lived here for 5 years. I mean, his presence here lasted about 5 years. He then enrolled for MA in philosophy. He completed his MA right here. In fact, spent both his BA and MA here in this dormitory, in this very dormitory.
Iqbal, as it seems to me, went through 2 periods in his life, a wisdom period and a love period.
During the time Iqbal was still in the subcontinent, and when he had not yet left for the West, he was naturally well acquainted with Western philosophy, had deeply studied Hinduism and Islamic thoughts.
At that time, Iqbal was quite familiar with Indian mysticism, and the traces of that school of thought can be found in his poems.
He studied in depth our religion. And with such a deep knowledge, he left for the West.
There was no ending to the stories of my restlessness and abandoning similar places. I was 28 when, recommended by my teacher, Sir Thomas Arnold, I left for Europe to continue my studies. Having a master's degree in philosophy, I had taught at the Oriental College, but going to England and starting study at Cambridge University for a doctorate in philosophy changed everything. Studying at Cambridge secured me opportunities to know better and more about Western philosophers. At the same time, I enrolled at the Faculty of Law to be able to get permission to act as attorney. The rest had no meaning to me. For that very year, I traveled to Hamburg, Germany, to do more research and finish my doctoral dissertation. For a whole year, I worked so hard to get fully familiar with philosophical foundations and to get my doctoral thesis finished. At that time, I met much of well-known philosophy teachers, such as the famous professor of philosophy, McNegrad, and the famous Orientalist, Reinhold Elin Nicholson.
در هایدلبرگ مطالعاتش رو علاوه بر تمریناتی که
He continued his university studies in Heidelberg, Germany, and became familiar with the thoughts and ideas of such philosophers as Nietzsche, Fichte, Schopenhauer, and the like. There were similarities between his thoughts and the thoughts of those learned men.
Iqbal continues to say that he was changing and thinking those days.
Interestingly enough, Iqbal was influenced by Western philosophers. He adopted their thoughts and opinions. He received ideas from them, but mixed them with his own to create an independent thought system and called it own philosophy.
Having received his Doctor of Philosophy, Iqbal returned at the age of 31 to Lahore. Never did he hesitate to return home, contrary to some students of that time. He left England quickly. He was then licensed to practice attorneyship and became a member of Lahore Bar Association. 3 years later, he became a lecturer in philosophy at Lahore University. He resigned after a while to exclusively practice as an attorney. This way, he was able to freely publish his thoughts. He continuously thought about finding a way to awaken Muslims taken captive by colonialism.
All my life has been coincident with the Indian subcontinent's darkest days. British colonialism and now World War I. India was dominated by colonialism since the 18th century. But as World War I began in August 1914, a new form of cruelty began to cover my land. Indians went to fight a war wherein they had played no role. They were killed and killed for people who themselves were the main factor in bringing ruin and destruction to the whole world. Description of troubles brought about by those calamities is actually impossible.
In 1910 and 1911, and after World War I, we see a number of liberation movements.
Muslims rose against British and European colonizers. So Iqbal found himself on a well-defined route. He started composing revolutionary poems.
After World War I in 1918 and the fall of the Ottoman Empire, something had to be done quickly to save people of the tyranny imposed on them. I knew that a worldwide caliphate was no longer practicable. There was no agreement between Islamic unity and blind religious prejudice or extreme nationalistic ideas as promulgated by colonial powers. Unwillingly, I engaged in political activities. I tried to raise public awareness to bring about self-reliance.
Allama ran for Punjab parliament election. As he said, he hated political activities and Muslims' needs forced him to enter the political arena. Consequently, he joined the Muslim League Party. He succeeded to become an MP for Punjab province for 3 years. During that time, he tried to solve Muslims' problems. Iqbal used to talk on such problems.
Allama Iqbal nurtured the wish for an independent Pakistan. He would say a new country, an Islamic country, would come into existence on the world map. The country's name, he would say, will be Pakistan. Iqbal did not give this name to a new country, but surely he had it as a Muslim country in mind.
During my lifetime, I liked those sleeping in the world of thought to wake up from their deep sleep. But sadly, the sleep is too deep. Therefore, I took refuge in the world of rhythmic words and meaningful poems to awaken the youths of this sorrowful nation in order to sail the craft of our thoughts to the shore of productivity. I was a young man when I found out that to weather horrible tempests and the enemy's lurking place, we had no way but recourse to the miracle of the last time. The Holy Quran, the book with miraculous words, which can be used as the best means to awaken thought and exalt the belief in self. The book is most succoring, particularly to the youth. I, who despair of the sages of old, have a word to say touching the day to come. Render my speech easy unto the young. Make my abyss for them attainable.
Iqbal's message is addressed only to the youth. He calls them Royal Falcons. As held by Iqbal, the Royal Falcon has five characteristics. Iqbal wants the youth to catch hold of Falcon's characteristics as much as possible. The five good attributes of the Royal Falcon, as seen by Iqbal, are flying high. So Iqbal wants the youth to fly high for sure. The second attribute is keen eyesight. The youth can fly high only if they have keen eyesight. Its third attribute is that it does not build a nest, nor does it follow richness. The fourth attribute, it loves solitude, as it is a source of creativity. The last attribute, as told by Iqbal of the Royal Falcon, is it does not eat the prey hunted by others. Iqbal wants the youth to show these five attributes.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you because you are
a Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear ladies. Welcome to another episode of Muslim Lady. In here, we're talking about the topics that are most interested to Muslim ladies. Well, I am Asma, your humble host. And here with me, I have Sister Zainab to help us with some information about the book that we recently have started to talk about. In this book, we are gathering some information about the personal and also social aspects of life of Sayyida Zahra, salamullah alayha. Since we as Muslim follow Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam because they are the practical example of the perfect Muslim according to the Holy Book of Quran, So we go for Lady Fatima, salamullah alayha, in order to get more of how to be a real Muslim lady.
Yeah.
So, in today's episode, we're going to talk about some remaining points about beauty, and then we would go for the next topic of this book that we are talking.
And I would like to name that book as
Yes, that would be very good.
That's the Ethics and Lifestyle of Lady Zahra, salamun alayha, a book by Dr. Muhammad Reza Jabari.
And since the book does not have an English translation, I guess,
yes,
we are going to just give you the gist of this book through some sessions. And we've been doing that quite some sessions. It's been so long right now.
Yeah.
Being the daughter of the Prophet, of the last Prophet of Allah, she is being so modest. But right now, what we see in our society is that women, if they get, a husband who is so much affluent or a father who is a tradesman or anything.
I just said if he's a business tycoon.
Yeah.
Then. Yeah.
Yeah. If they are like that, they would believe that they must be recognized by every single man and women outside. You know what I mean?
That's why
they do not love to stay modest.
When we talked about the clothing, we said avoid using clothes that make you center of attraction or pick you particularly out from a crowd. When we talked about beauty and personal care, we said to not wear perfumes or anything on your body that makes you again center of attraction.
Yeah, and we said that as women, naturally, we do have this interest, this urge to be noticeable by others. But that doesn't mean that every single man outside should know me.
What is Islam? What does the word Islam mean in itself? Submitting. Yeah. Submitting to Allah. Surrendering. It's basically to surrender. When you're surrendering, okay, I give
up. Exactly.
I give up. Islam knows.
I give everything in my life up for Allah.
Yes. When you know that I love this particular thing, but you give it up for the sake of Allah, that's like surrenderance. That's giving up in the way of Allah. And that's what the word Islam in itself means.
Exactly.
To surrender, to submit. In our previous episode, we ended with the fact that the very beautiful question that was asked in the mosque among the men, and the answer was given by Lady Zahra, salamu alayha, indirectly, and when it reached to Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family, he said that definitely Fatima is a part of me. And what the answer was, what was the question and what was the answer? The question was, what is the best thing for a female? The answer was, the best thing for a female is that she does not get looked by any non-mahram or no non-mahram. She also
does not
look at...
That means she keeps her dignity. All a woman has, all a lady owns, is her dignity, her character.
Exactly. Now today, you are out there in a society, mm-hmm. you have to work with men, And they are definitely non-mahram.
Too much of interactions between men and women.
In the metros, in the buses.
Yeah, in the buses.
In the streets.
Because women have brought into society and they've been into public situations more and more.
You have to be in public sector out there. Now, does that mean that you don't have to look at a non-mahram or non-mahram does not have to look at you? I'll explain that, Asma, if you want to go for a short break.
Inshallah. Let's go for a short break, dear listeners, and we'll be back.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back to your ladies. This is Muslim Lady in here with Sister Zainab. We are having some discussions about the book that we are covering, which has been quite actually a long time that we're doing it. We were talking about the beauty, and we reached to the point that you actually recited a narrative, a story from Sayyidah Zahra Salamullah Alayha. You said there was a question, and that was, what is the best thing for a woman? And she answered that the best thing for a woman is to keep herself away from the gist of it is like this, the talks of other men or women.
And she also herself does not talk about other non-mahrams.
Yeah, and to keep her dignity. What is so much beautiful about a woman is her dignity, and how that dignity is going to be achieved through being modest.
The best thing for a woman is that she does not look at any non-mahram or no non-mahram looks at her. This is the answer she gives. This means, does that mean that you can't go out in the public sector and you can't work? No, it never means that.
Yeah, we were just talking about it.
I would emphasize on the point that you may have different interpretations. That's okay. It's my personal interpretation that we, as women, we are also working in a public sector. We go out in the streets.
Yeah,
we
have
conversations with the public.
Inevitably, you're going to meet too much of men.
You know, just to put it in simple words, Asma, it means that you do not act in a society in a way in front of a non-mahram. When she says do not look at non-mahram, it does not mean that while you're conversating, while you're in a meeting, just lower your gaze and all. Lower your gaze when you feel like the situations are going somewhere else. The things
you know what, sister? I usually, when I hear this sentence, I just take it like this way, that we shouldn't look at it as the literal way it has been said. I think it's mostly has a metaphorical connotation.
Exactly. When we have the same verse in Quran, which says to men that lower your gaze, it does not mean that while you're walking on the street, non-mahram women are also coming out. It never means that. Close your eyes or completely put your head down so that you just strike with a towel to take care of your health, to take care of the surroundings. You have traffic signals, you have different things you have to look upon, you have to take care.
Yeah.
When you say that don't look at non-mahrams, is that try to keep your modesty. Try to keep your dignity.
And do not penetrate on the things
because
that you're looking.
Because there is so much, a woman, there was a joke. There was a joke some time ago going on the social media some women were talking. They were saying when someone wants to propose a woman, woman knows before a man comes and proposes her.
Yeah.
She also knows who is the next person coming up. Why I mentioned this joke here, which has a little link to this discussion of ours, is that, yes, you as a woman have these intuitions. What can you get the sense that what other man is thinking about you, or what other man is, what kind of viewpoint or the image he has of yours?
You know, we have this feeling, this sense.
Women have this very strong sense.
We as women.
When you have that sense. Try to ignore, try to avoid, try to, if you're covering or your appearance is in a way, that is not keeping, becoming a barrier in the modesty of your Muslim brother. try to, you know, compose yourself.
Exactly.
Try to this means this. This does not mean that do not go out, do not work, which is a stereotype, actually.
Yeah.
Which is a kind of like thought in the societies that this is there. We got to treat this thing. We have to keep modesty. Help your Muslim brothers to keep modesty, whatever the way you can.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very true. So, dear ladies, let's go for a short break. And then after that, we'll be back. Thank you for staying with us. Welcome back, Muslim ladies. Well, we were talking about how to keep it modest. And we actually mentioned this very fact that when we say that a woman should keep her dignity just in a way that she could not be distinguished in every single crowd she goes, we actually mentioned that. We do not mean that a woman must stay at home or a Muslim woman is just restricted to stay at home to be kept away from social works. No. On the contrary, you can see many Muslim women who are doing wonders all around the world.
Yeah.
Yet they have their hijab, they have their covers.
When you're making yourself center of attraction through your clothing, through your perfumes, or through any other means, you're violating the human rights that are related to yourself.
This is very
true.
Because
public, men, women out there who are respecting you, who are knowing you, they know you because of your dresses.
Exactly.
They know you because of your appearance. I'm trying to say, when you make yourself center of attraction, the men out there, the women out there, because sometimes women try to make themselves a center of attraction by just removing their hijab.
Appearance is the thing that represents you to other people.
No, it's actually when you removed your hijab and you made yourself center of attraction through your hair. Because when we said do not make yourself center of attraction, it does not limit to your clothes only.
Yeah.
It limits even to your, it goes back to you, what kind of perfumes you use, and also your behavior. Because I have seen Asma, people out there who actually use very modest clothes, very long clothes, very good appearance. But in their behavior and talks, they always try to be center of attraction.
Exactly.
This signals that they have some weaknesses in the families. They have some lack of love in the family. Mm-hmm. Go and treat yourself that way. Go and talk to your partners. Go and talk to your parents to give you more attention. Do not seek that attention in this society. That's really, really bad. You know, you as mothers give maximum attention to your daughters. Give maximum love to your daughters. You as mothers definitely love your daughters, but express that love. Because until and unless you're not expressing that love, what will happen is that you're creating troubles for yourself. Mm-hmm. You're going to seek that love outside one or the other way. Now we're talking about human rights violations. What I meant was that people out there, when you make yourself center of attraction, they know you by your hair, they know you by your, I don't know, makeup appearance, or they know you by your center of attraction dresses. And whenever you have to prove yourself out in the society, you always have to go and make those expenses to get the center of attraction dresses, to get the same perfumes, to get, I don't know, just in order to show yourself.
Yeah.
The inner you is getting suffocated.
Exactly.
The inner you is dying. And this is the biggest kind of human rights violation you can do to yourself.
Yeah.
So in order to make yourself known in the society, make yourself known to your friends, use intellect.
Exactly.
Let them know you through your intellect. Let them know you through your heart. Let them know you through your actions.
Yeah.
Not through your appearance. Through your appearance. That's the biggest kind of violation you're doing to yourself. And unfortunately, those who raise the slogans of feminism and all, they're trying to cover this and make the story upside down.
They're deviating the true story. Well, that's very true. And just to mention another thing, well, actually, this is the gist of what we were talking about. We as human beings who live in the same society, in the same country, in the same city, whatever community we have, we have just something that is called domino effect.
Yeah.
Whatever that I do is not going to just have an effect on my personal life. It's going to affect another person, another person, another person. So if the women themselves are trying to make the world go in a direction that the other citizens of this world, which mean the men, look only at their appearance.
It's not about my choice, my body.
Exactly.
It's about keeping modesty of your brothers.
So it's going to be the same thing as you just mentioned. So if these women are changing the situation, they are violating the rights of other women.
Exactly.
Which is so much wrong. Yeah. And I hope for an intellectual society in which all men and women know what they're doing, and for Muslim ladies to rocket on and more and more. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us. I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. But this waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, brothers and sisters, dear listeners, welcome to Mafatihul Hayat, Keys of Life. I am your host, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi. Another key of life throughout the words of the Ahlul Bayt, the Holy Infallibles, is the notion of sickness and medication. The Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, you see that in one time, they are emphasizing on the fact that we need to take medication. In another time, you see that the Ahl Bayt alayhim as-salam emphasizing on the fact that we should not take medication. How do we combine and reconcile these ahadith? So first, let's look at the concept of pain. We see many ahadith from the Ahl Bayt alayhim as-salam that tells us, don't seek medication straightforward. First, try to bear and handle the pain. For example, we see a hadith from the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam. He says, أربعةٌ من كنوز الجنة: كتمان الصدقة، كتمان المرض، كتمان المصيبة، كتمان الوجع. Four things are the treasures of heaven: concealing your charity that you give, concealing your disease, concealing your calamity, and concealing your pain. Now, obviously, no one should take this in the wrong way. He says, well, I got cancer. The Prophet says, keep it. I'm not going to the doctors. The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam, in this hadith, he says, sometimes the sickness itself is not that severe. The pain is not serious. I have a cold, I have a flu, I have a fever. And sometimes people, you know, they get a fever, but they, you know, bring the world upside down. I'm going to die. This is going to happen to me. I'm this. It's just a fever. It's just a small thing, small pain. Hold it, keep it to yourself, and move on. It's not a big deal, you know. You're not going to die from a fever or a cold. Well, I mean, sometimes it depends on the fever itself. But you be the judge of that. You decide. So first and foremost, the first approach to any disease, let's see what the disease is. Let's see if it's bearable. Let's see if it's controllable. And sometimes I feel a problem. I have a problem. I go to the doctor. The doctor tells me, this is your problem. This is the medication. But I still keep whining about it. It's enough. I mean, you know, you got the medication, you diagnose yourself, you try to bear the pain until you get healthy. Take your medication, get some rest, but keep it to yourself. Conceal it to yourself. Conceal disease. You don't have to go tell the world that you got this and that, and tell the world that you're taking this medication and that medication, and tell the world how much pain you have. You went to the doctors, you got your medication, you're okay now. So don't go around telling people what has happened to you, which a lot of people sadly seem to do. So the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam, he says, concealing it is in fact a treasure of heaven. So next time we get sick, and inshallah none of you will get sick, but in case we do, we need to learn to conceal these pains and conceal our diseases, because sometimes when I go tell people that I am sick, I might get them to worry. So no need to worry, people. Inshallah, we'll get healthy as long as we keep taking our medication and keep taking our bodies. The idea is keep it to yourself first and foremost. Let us take a short break and then we continue right after.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
یه جلدش کم داره و اون اینه که فرون درختکاری اینجا کم ثواب داره دعا هم داره ثواب هم داره
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام اونطوری که اینو گفته بودم گفته دی اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری اون ثواب داره
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Mafatihul Hayat, Keys of Life. We're talking about medication and disease. We see that the Ahl Bayt alayhim as-salam, they tell us that first and foremost, try to bear the pain. Don't go around announcing it to the whole world and trying to seek sympathy and empathy and whatever is between these two. Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, in a beautiful hadith, he says, "Imshi bida'ika ma mashabik." He says when you go through a disease, you try to hold it as much as you can. I mean, don't straight away jump to medication and, you know, take tablets right, left, and center. See if it's something that you can bear, if it's a cold or a flu or a fever that you can hold. You know, go with it. Go with the pain. And don't try to jump to medication, because even science today and medicine today, they tell us that taking all this medication have side effects. Sometimes we get like a small headache and straight away we jump to the tablets and start taking all this medication. It's not required. I got a small headache, it will wear off in an hour or 2 hours. It's not a big deal. You know, you get a bruise on the body or you get inflammation somewhere in your body, it will, you know, a couple of hours will die out. You got back pain, it will die out in a day or two or in a matter of hours sometimes. So don't jump to medication and painkillers straight away. So he says, imshi bidaik, walk with your disease and your pain as long as you can. If it comes to a stage where you cannot bear the pain anymore, then you can take medication. Sometimes when I got a toothache, I try to bear the pain as much as I can. When it becomes unbearable, then I, you know, take a painkiller. With a lot of people, the minute they feel pain, the minute the indication of pain comes, they jump to medication. This is not required. So the Ahl Bayt always talk about this and they say, do not jump to medication. A hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, لَا يَتَدَاوَى الْمُسْلِمُ حَتَّى يَغْلِبُ مَرَضَهُ صَحَّتَهُ. A true Muslim will not jump to medication straight away until his sickness overtakes him completely. There's no more health in him. Like he's completely paralyzed, he's in bed and he cannot move. In this matter, in this case, sure, let him to go to medication. But not straight away. Even the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam in another hadith, he says, لَا تَكْرُهُ الدَّمَامِيلِ فَإِنَّهَا أَمَانٌ مِنَ الْبَرَصِ. He says, when you have dimples in your body, don't go straight away trying to get rid of them and to extract the blood and the stuff inside it. Just leave it. Why? He says, because it will save you from leprosy. So obviously there's a link between dimples and leprosy. And the Prophet says, don't be too quick. Let it die out naturally. Let it die. Let the blood and whatever is inside fade away by itself, because it could cause another disease if you try to tamper with it. So you can see that the Ahl Bayt alayhim wassalam, they're constantly saying to us, first approach to disease is not medication, is understanding the pain, trying to hold on with the pain, trying to figure out the pain. And when we come to a stage where we see that our health, we have no more left of it, then we jump to medication and get it. Because sometimes, as we will see in other narrations, medication itself ends up being the cause of death to a lot of people. And we don't realize that fact. But the hadith, they actually speak about this. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams. Hear the children's screams.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
Hidden Files.
When you're limited from employment, education, participating in the society, and seen as a second-class citizen in every way, what do? Imagine you're part of the majority in your own country, and yet you're prohibited from being employed in top positions. What if you can't get accepted into the university despite being a top student? You're not allowed to serve in most political offices, and on top of this, you're not allowed to vocalize your oppression. And those who have are either in prison or have fled the country or have been killed. Welcome to Bahrain, the country where the demographics are being changed to oppress the Shia majority. A country where if you talk about the ruling family, you could lose your own citizenship, even though you are from this land. Hello, I'm Marzia Hashimi, and this is Hidden Files. Today we will take a look at Bahrain, a country which is boiling over with oppression. While the king wants to show the world that the country is modern and democratic, and by the way, he's throwing an election to prove his point. Stay with me as we take a look at the tiny but important Persian Gulf nation of Bahrain. Since the brutal crackdown in 2011, the regime has kept a very heavy-handed grip on this island nation. The oppression is in all sectors of the society. There's a special permit that people must have in order to really function in the society, meaning for jobs, schools, organizations, even bank accounts, etc. Those who participated in demonstrations are not given these certificates or permits for them to get employment. There is no independent media allowed, and independent human rights organizations have been banned. And those who have tried to report on the human rights situation in Bahrain are in jail. They include Abdulhadi Al-Khawaja, founder of the Bahrain Center for Human Rights, and others who are serving life sentences. Well, in the midst of this crackdown, King Hamad bin Isa Al-Khalifa wants to represent the country as being progressive. He's holding elections to select 40 members of the Council of Representatives to be held on November 12th. What he fails to mention is that many former parliamentarians are currently in jail or in exile and have had their citizenship taken away by the king, and that the majority of Bahrainis boycott elections, which they say are not representative and just a farce to have a pretense of democracy and a facade to cover the complete oppression of a nation. Well, let me welcome our first guest to help us take a closer look at just what is taking place in Bahrain.
Dr. Ibrahim El-Aradi graduated from medical school in 2005 and returned to work in Bahrain. He treated many injured people during the revolt. He had to leave Bahrain in April 2011. He has worked in Europe and Lebanon as a doctor and is currently in England. He is the director of the Political Bureau of the February 14 Coalition.
Thanks so much for joining us here at Hidden Files, Dr. Ibrahim Al-Aradi. Well, let's start off with, what is life really like in Bahrain today?
Bahrain cannot say your idea. You cannot say anything for the life, for example. You cannot criticize the government. You cannot say no for the regime. You have to stay just for even your religions, prayers, Aza, anything, Ashura, Al-Khalifa, treating us every time, every day, every seasons. So they doesn't want Shia, especially Shia, to have such level like any level at the government or the country. They bring a new people in Bahrain. They give them our nationality, and they talk from us the citizenships. So nobody allowed to speak normally in Bahrain, like to say what is in his mind. We are not allowed to criticize anything in the country. Al-Khalifa wants us just to live like, sorry to say that, even worse than animals in Bahrain. So there's no freedom in Bahrain. We have one of the worst dictator regimes in the world is in Bahrain. And the head of these regimes is Hamad Al-Khalifa, who destroyed more than 35 mosques in Bahrain.
Well, why has the regime been revoking the citizenship of some that you just talked about while giving citizenship to foreigners?
To change the demographic of Bahrain, because more than 80% of population of Bahrain, they are Muslim Shia. So they want to change. This the plan was from 25 for 20 from 20.